You're listening to the AHDB podcast, practical know-how to help your farm business. Hello, and welcome to this cereals and oilseeds episode of the AHDB podcast. I'm Tom Hebbert, and this time we're looking at the updates in the new nutrient management guide known as RB209. RB209 helps you make the most of organic materials and balance the benefits of fertilizer use against the costs, both economic and environmental. The latest edition of RB209, published this month, contains some of the most significant changes to phosphorus, or P, use in over 30 years. AHDB's Sajjad Awan helped write the new guide. Communication manager Jason Pohl caught up with him to find out more.
The AHDB Nutrient Management Guide, often referred to as RB209, has become an indispensable part of fertiliser, manure and slurry use planning. Our continued investment in nutrient management research means the guidance now gets an annual update. I'm joined today by Sajjad Awan, who is part of the RB209 project team. We're going to find out a little bit more about the guide and the key changes in the 2020 edition, specifically for growers of cereals. Sajjad, thanks for joining me today. RB209 is a true cross-sector initiative, isn't it? It cuts right across cropping sectors. It covers crop and grassland systems. But with so many recommendations to consider, how does the RB209 team identify those priorities for research?
We conduct a review. The review of the available data, what has previously been done, and that information could come from the UK or the similar conditions to the UK, for instance. Previously, we used data from Ireland as well as from Denmark. We have established a nutrient management partnership. This partnership includes almost every single sector. So we've got arable sector. This is where I lead the technical working group. Then we have a horticulture technical working group and a livestock technical working group. And these all three technical working groups, they are headed by our steering group. So in these technical working groups, we have the industry. So we have got a lot of hundreds of years worth of experience sat in a room from agronomists. Then we have got representatives from the devolved governments from Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. We also have the farmers. So all these people, they review the information, these knowledge gaps, and then they identify that this is something that should be done, and then we decide that we should go ahead and conduct the research.
That's brilliant. So you go out and you consult with the whole of the industry, you start with the farmers, and you talk to the researchers and the people involved in the fertilizer industry. That's fantastic. But the guidance can make such a big difference to how much fertilizer is applied. Bearing in mind this influence, how does the Nutrient Management Partnership decide what needs to change in the guidance?
The guidance, actually, once we have identified the knowledge gaps, we fund the research. These experiments, they conducted throughout the country. So we identify the locations, different locations which cover the differences in the soil conditions and also the environmental conditions. And these are randomly set trials. So these trials, they produce the information. Normally they range between 3 to 5 years. Once we have got the data, all the information, then the researchers who lead this research, they come and they present their findings to the technical working groups. Now, technical working groups, they discuss that whether there is enough evidence available to warrant changes in RB209. If there is enough evidence available, then we go ahead and make changes. And if we think that more data is required, then we continue doing more research or gathering more information. Or they could say simply that actually this information wasn't useful enough because of the way that the weather behaved or the current recommendations in RB209, they were justified. Then we don't make any changes.
I mean, that's a really important point, the fact that you need compelling evidence to make a change to RV209. If the evidence isn't there, then the guidance remains as it is. That's such an important point to make.
Absolutely.
So in terms of cereals, those phosphorus recommendations, they've not had much change recently until now. They've had quite a bit of a shake-up in the new edition. So can you tell us a little bit more about those changes and, importantly, how significant are they?
Phosphorus for the past 35 to 40 years has not seen much of a change in RV209. So what you are seeing now is actually once in a generation change in RV209. So there might not be a massive increase or decrease in phosphate recommendations, but actually we have tried to fine-tune which was proposed, let's say, about 40 years ago in RB209. So the key changes that we made in RB209, they as a result of 10 years worth of trials. So these trials, they identified one of the most important things I would like to mention here is that these trials identified that the offtake of pea in grains in winter wheat was actually less than what was proposed in RB209. So it was proposed that it was 7.8 kilogram per ton of fresh weight of grains. But our research showed actually this was about 6.5 kilogram per ton of fresh weight. Although it does not look a massive decrease, but if you look at 10 tons and then you've got several thousand hectares, it makes a massive change. Phosphorus in the system, if it's not fine-tuned, if we do not consider the exact requirements for the crop, the excessive amounts, they can easily be washed away into the rivers, into the streams, and they are causing a lot of issues to the aquatic life. Two important changes that we made. We have reduced winter wheat recommendations. So these will be in section 4. And secondly, as a result of demand from a lot of fat strainers that the yields mentioned for phosphorus were different compared to the yields mentioned for nitrogen. So we have aligned both nitrogen and phosphorus yields for all the cereal crops. So what you see, if it's 8 tons of winter wheat for nitrogen, it's 8 tons of winter wheat for phosphorus as well. Similarly, if it's 6.5 tons for winter barley, for nitrogen is 6.5 tons for winter barley for phosphorus.
Well, thanks, Sajjad, for explaining those changes. The nutrient management is always changing. It's never going to be a static picture, and it's reassuring that AHDB now has taken the reins and is investing in nutrient management research to make sure we can keep up to date with the best practice, and indeed as the varieties change and evolve. So in terms of the latest RB209 information, how can people get their hands on that then?
They should be available on AHDB/RB209. That is the link to go to and download your new copies. Similarly, you can download PDFs digital format. You can also use our apps.
Thanks, Sajjad. Now, the phosphorus story has been fascinating. I mean, it involves decades of research, and these have been pored over by the RB209 project team. And at the Agronomist Conference back in December, Roger Sylvester Bradley explored all of those trials in detail and gave the story to how they've come up with the new recommendations that you'll see in RB209. Now, you can access that video through the RB209 website, as Sajjad mentioned. That is ahdb.org.uk/RB209. Now, the page also includes extensive details about what has changed across all 7 sections of the guide.
As Sajjad mentioned, the new pea guidance follows a whopping 10 years worth of trials. The man who led the research was Professor Roger Sylvester Bradley, Head of Crop Performance at ADAS. Here he is to explain how the new guidance was developed.
We did several successive projects. There were a lot of organisations involved in the research, including Rothamsted and NIAB, as well as ADAS, and it was supported by the industry as well as by HDB, so it's been a really effective But as we have to learn with phosphorus, everything happens slowly. So it's taken us a long time, 10 years, to really work out how to improve the phosphorus work, the phosphorus recommendations that we've inherited from really a previous generation. I mean, what we're doing in the current RB209, not the new RB209, was worked out in the 1970s or 1960s, so it's taken a long time to sort of review how well it was working.
That's fantastic. And I understand that there was 4 research reviews, 6 research reports, and 1 3-page summary.
Yes, I think it's 766 pages. So there's a lot to read if you want to read it. Yes, I hope I can summarise that. I mean, if you want to, what it all says in a quick sort of technical overview, I mean, clearly phosphorus is a cost to arable producers. The recommendations we've inherited basically advocated that we built the fertility levels up in our topsoils so that we have these indices. So we have index 0, which is deficient, index 1, which is a bit borderline, index 2, which is satisfactory, and then 3, 4, and 5, which generally for most crops are more than is necessary, but for some crops like potatoes, you need to be at index 3 or thereabouts. So, yeah, so we have this philosophy of soil storage of P, but that has environmental issues because P, although it's not terribly mobile, it does run off, and you only need a little bit of P in your water to start making it eutrophic and fish suffering and so on. So there's a big concern about P, and P is actually one of the main causes of water quality failures according to EU regulations. So we really need to be aware of what we're doing to the environment. We analyse soil in order to work out how much P it's got in it, but in fact that analysis, it tries to tell us about what is available to the crop, but what is available to the crop is a very small part of the total quantity of phosphorus in the soil. There's exchangeable P in the soil which has to be built up in order to provide, to make sure that there's enough available P to the crop. And that's the issue, that we have a much bigger P store than is actually available to the crop. So, and to do that, we generally, in the arable world, because livestock are not plentiful in the east part of the country where we grow most of our arable crops, we have to use fertilisers to build up the P store. And the fertilizers are quite rapidly, the phosphorus, although it's water soluble when we apply it, it becomes fairly rapidly immobilized, a lot of it does. So it's quite an inefficient process to increase this soil store of P.
When you were doing this research over the last 10 years, what were the main challenges that you came across during this research, and how did you go about tackling them?
Finding uniform sites where we could do some experiments where the P levels were not plentiful, so that we could actually show which fertilisers were better than and which techniques were better at actually getting P into the crop. So we struggled to find sites which were at index 1. That's where we decided we would do our experiments, where they were at index 1. And it was quite difficult to find those sites. But in the end, we've done 11, I think, different experiments, testing different fertilizer strategies and fertilizer quantities, which has given us an understanding of how efficient, or in fact how inefficient, the fertilizers are. The main fertilizer we treated as our control was triple superphosphate, and we found that the crops immediately grown after the phosphorus was applied, we're only recovering about 4% of it. So it's a very inefficient way of feeding our crops.
You recently gave a talk at the Agronomist Conference about these changes, and one of the big things that you mentioned about this new guidance is this idea of testing the grain. You said this was quite an important way of moving forward. Can you just talk a bit more about that and explain what you meant?
Yeah, first of all, it's sort of important to recognise the reason for doing this. I mean, when we analyse our soils, as I've said, we hope that the extraction method we use in the Olsen P analysis reflects what the crop is able to acquire, the quantity of phosphorus it's able to acquire, and that the relationship between what the crop acquires, what the soil appears to have in it from analysis, isn't terribly good. A lot of work was done by particularly Rothamsted and Nyab looking at what the critical levels of soil P were. The critical levels are actually very variable. Some are in index 0 even. In other words, that's the level at which there's no further increase in yield if you increase the soil P. So some were at index 0, some were at index 1, most were at index 2, and some were at index 3. So the soil analysis hasn't proved to be brilliant at predicting where you need to be trying to increase your soil P level and where you can let it run down. In the end, we came to the conclusion that it is possible to farm satisfactorily at index 1 rather than at index 2, but only if you're growing good crops, establishing them reliably and satisfactorily, which in the current season isn't something that people would rely on, would say they could rely on. And then sowing them in the autumn. So if there's a long establishment phase, then it seems possible to farm index 1. But generally, it's better to have to maintain index 2. But then again, it's, as I say, it's not a terribly reliable thing. So we decided it would be interesting. First of all, we didn't think it would end up as being a thing we could do routinely, but we thought it would be interesting to analyse the grain for phosphorus content to see whether how much it was taking off. And the first thing we found was that it was taking off a lot less than the RB209, the old RB209 has been suggesting. So we reduced the offtake figure from 7.8 kilograms per ton to 6.5 kilograms per ton. But then we looked at whether we could use grain analysis to indicate whether the crop had actually suffered a yield loss because it couldn't find enough phosphorus. And we found, to our surprise, that this was quite a good way of diagnosing whether a crop had enough. And this figure of 0.32 has now been 0.32% P in the dry matter, which is what you get back from your grain analysis if you submit it to the lab, is the sort of threshold that we're suggesting. Below that, you should be thinking about improving the P supply to your crops.
If I'm a farmer, how would I go about assessing the grain? What's the best way of doing that? Is it quite a simple process? Or?
Well, you need to think how you manage your phosphorus nutrition. So if you're doing it field by field, which is what most people do, they need to get a sample that represents the whole field. So the best way of doing that is when the trailers are coming in at harvest time into the grain store or wherever you're taking your grain, you take a couple of handfuls from each trailer as you tip it, so, and put them in a bucket, and that bucket you keep putting them in as the trailers come in from that field, and at the end of when that field's finished, you mix that bucket of grain up and take a handful out and put it into a bag and label it clearly and put it on one side, and at the end of harvest you have a series of bags, one from each field, and you submit those to the laboratory in the end. But we think, because this is a new thing, it will be very useful to actually be able to compare your result with everybody else's result, which we call benchmarking. And so ADAS is organising to have a benchmarking service. So what you need to do if you want to do the benchmarking, just rather than having one result for your field, you'll be able to compare it with everybody else's result. You need to register that to do that with ADAS before harvest.
We've talked about the grain analysis and we've talked about the critical grain P level. Are there any other sort of key headline results you think were different from what's been previous editions of RB209?
Well, the two main ones are to take even more care when you're organising your soil analysis. So try and make sure that everything from field to field and from year to year, you're always sampling to the same depth. Ideally, it would be the same person walking in the same W shape across the field, thing to the same depth at the same time of year at the same place in the rotation, so that you know you're comparing like with like. Ideally, you would do a lot of fields at once, and if you haven't got many fields, ideally you would coordinate what you're doing with a neighbour or something like that, so you've got a lot of samples to look at, so you can see the oddball results, because there are oddball results, and you need to be able to recognise those. You also need to be in another aspect of this care with soil analysis is you need to be doing your sums of what you expect the change to have been since the last time you analysed that field. If you've been taking off in your crops more P than you've been applying in your fertilisers and manures, you need to know that, so that when you see a result from your soil analysis, you'll be able to judge it's close to what you expect or it's not close to what you expect. And if it's not close to what you expect, you need to double check it, maybe by asking the lab to reanalyze it. So that's the first thing, care with soil analysis, real care with soil analysis. But the second thing is this, as I've already said, about possibly being able to farm at index one, as long as everything's sort of, the wind's all in your favour.
So Roger, can you talk a bit more about the environmental work that's gone into the research, and also ultimately what this new guidance is going to mean for the farmer's bottom line?
I mean, obviously the costs of phosphorus analysis are a really serious concern, both the environmental and the economic costs. And because we've found such inefficiencies in the fertiliser use and the way we have to build up our soil fertility for many years before we reach satisfactory levels, it's obviously a worry for the environment. And the work we've done has shown that even at, as low as index two, you know, you can have index 5, 6 or 7, and obviously at those levels then the risk to the environment is significant. But even at index 2, maintaining the soils at index 2 still bears the risk of causing water failure in streams and rivers down the line. So we certainly need to, you know, to be responsible farmers, we need to be aware of that. But also, it's affecting our bottom line. Building up a big reserve of phosphorus in the soil represents a significant investment over the years. And I think I calculated some figures once that there was a sort of, for a farm of 1,000 acres, there was something like a bill, just in interest on the capital invested, was significant, sort of £5,000 a year or something like that. So it's definitely a job to do to try and improve the efficiency with which we're improving the nutrition, the phosphorus nutrition.
And how can we improve the efficiency of our fertiliser use?
Well, we began to look at this. By no means have we finished looking at it, and there's a lot more work to do. But we started by just comparing triple superphosphate with struvite, which is a product of sewage treatment. And in fact, it's a very slow release form of phosphorus. And it was very interesting that the slow release doubled the efficiency compared with the water-soluble phosphorus, the immediately water-soluble phosphorus, which is quite counterintuitive, but it sort of shows what the crop needs. It needs this slow trickle of phosphorus that's it can take up right through its life, but which isn't going to be fixed so quickly. And probably this means that one of the most efficient ways of getting phosphorus into a crop is actually as in livestock manures, because what they do is mineralise very slowly, release the phosphorus slowly, and that becomes available to the crop as it wants it, and not to the soil to be fixed. But, you know, not everybody has livestock manures, so I think that there's a lot of innovative fertiliser companies out there who are producing products that claim to be more efficient, and what we need to be doing with growers in the future is testing these products so that we can come up with reliable data about which are the most efficient ones and improve the efficiency year on year.
That was Roger Sylvester Bradley speaking about the research behind the new guidance. If you'd like to find out more, you can watch Roger's presentation from last year's Agronomist Conference in December. Visit ahdb.org.uk/events/agconf19 and scroll down to watch the live stream from the day. You can also find links to Roger's presentation slides. And now, here's James Price, who farms in Oxfordshire, on his current pea strategy and what the new guidance means for him and his business.
So I've been on the main Cereals North Sea board for nearly 6 years now. So I'm just coming to the end of my term, and I've been involved with RB209 and specifically the Arable Technical Working Group since AHDB took over looking after RB209. It's given me a unique insight into revisions to date, and also it's allowed me as a farmer to have a voice in the process. Although I chair the meetings, I also still have the opportunity to say my piece.
Could you just tell us a bit more about your farm and how long you've been farming there and what you grow?
I've been farming for 21 years now, I think, since I came back from college. We're on a sort of thin Cotswold grass soil. Some people describe it as farming a pavement. And we also contract farm some nicer ground as well. As a general rule in our rotation, we'll grow winter wheat, spring barley, winter beans. This year we've changed to spring oats and an oilseed rape if we can get it to grow. And then for this harvest, for harvest 20, we'll be cutting about 1,000 hectares.
When it comes to the new guidance in RB209, obviously one of the main changes is the guidance on phosphorus, or P. Could you tell me a bit about your current P fertiliser strategy and what you currently use on your farm?
So what we've been doing at home is a strategy that sort of It's evolved as we've gone along. I can't say I had a grand master plan when we set off. I've just sort of stumbled my way through the industry to a certain extent. But in 2005, we started off with GPS sampling on a grid basis, which was okay. That was the first step into what we were doing in terms of working out what our analysis was. And it changed us away from doing a blanket application every year of a 0.24 compound into targeting specifics of what the nutrients were in the fields. We moved on from there quite quickly into target sampling according to soil types. So what the initial sampling showed me was basically what my soil type was because of offtake. So the better the soil, the higher the offtake, the lower the indices. And we then moved into target sampling, which gives me a better idea of what we've got in the soils. But at the same time, since 2003, we've been putting a lot of organic manures on the farm of one form or another. And since about 2007, we've been putting roughly 8,000 tonne a year on sort of 1,000 acres that we farm at home. And that's a mixture of all sorts, from sewage cake to compost, cow muck, and then we used to use coffee waste a long time ago, and now we use clean water sludge as well. So we're putting an awful lot of organic manure and organic nutrition back into the ground. And because of that, we actually haven't applied any bagged pea since 2007. We do place a little bit at drilling, so it's not strictly out of the bag, it's liquid, but we only do that for oilseed rape at the moment, but we're sort of investigating whether we really do that further in the future.
So, James, could you tell me about your pea fertiliser strategy and what you currently use on farm?
So what we've done on farm sort of evolved over the years, not necessarily through a strategic plan or anything, it's just how I sort of bumbled my way through the industry and things that have been available at the time. So we started back in 2005 with precision sampling on a grid-based system. Prior to that, we'd just been blanket applying 0.24 as a compound every year just because of the crop need. But we thought, right, this is the thing to do, we'll go on to GPS sampling. So we did that. It was very interesting, gave us some very pretty maps. But fundamentally, what it showed me was my soil type. So the better the soil, the higher the yield, the higher the offtake, therefore the lower the nutrition. So that was what it first showed us. When we fairly quickly moved on to say, okay, well, the next time we sampled in 2009, we went for target sampling. So we looked at soil type within the field and then picked indices or picked sample points out of there that then was relevant to what we were trying to do. So we made it cheaper, more efficient, and a lot more, I feel, a lot more accurate in terms of what we were doing. But at the same time, since 2003, we started buying a lot of organic manures, and from sort of 2007 onwards, we've been exceeding 8,000 tonne a year on 1,000 to 1,100 acres at home. So what that's done is meant that all my supply of P and K and other nutrients as well has all come in an organic form. Now, that's taken the organic manure comes in different forms itself, so we've had sewage cake, compost, cow muck, we've dabbled with digestate, we did take coffee waste at one point, and now we use clean water sludge as well. So we haven't put any artificial pea out of a bag on since 2007, but we do place a little bit when we're planting rape in the harvest when we're drilling. So that's the only fresh pea we put on.
Do you face any challenges with your pea nutrition? And if so, what are these challenges?
So our soils at home are very thin, and they've also got a very high calcium levels. So we've known for quite a long time that although we're applying a lot of organic manures and organic pea, I'm not sure how much is available. And the samples that we take show that we have good indices, but is that pea actually available to the plant? So our biggest problem is nutrient lockup because of a high pH level. And so what we've started to change this year, and we're doing lots of more detailed tests, and the first result we've had back shows that we've got fantastic indices in the soil. We've got lots of availability, potential availability. We just need to make sure that is actually there, ready for the plant.
So can you tell me how you manage these challenges?
So recent guidance is suggesting moving towards fresh pea, supplying the crop what it needs as it's growing. And principally, we've got enough in the ground, that's okay. So the critical time for us now is establishments. Now, we know that high calcium soils, high pH soils, that we've got nutrient lockups, so I can't change my soil's pH, I can't acidify it very easily. So we're looking now towards placing more, so we're now looking to place fresh pea at when we're doing cereals as well, as a bit of an experiment. And at the same time, maybe we've put so much muck on that we don't actually need to put any more on. There's by the very nature of applying organic manures, there's a lot of wheelings involved, whether we're taking the straw off or applying the muck following. So we're also perhaps looking at reducing the amount of organic manure we put on, and then perhaps using a slightly more robust cover crop mix than what we've been doing to date.
In your view, do you think that these new recommendations will help you achieve a better yield? And if so, how?
So with the change to the guidance, there's been a change in the offtake figures and a reduction in the amount required for growing winter wheat. In our situation at home, I don't think it's going to make an awful lot of difference, because our limiting factor is not, it's certainly not my pea indices, and it's probably not even the availability of pea. I think it's very much more a case of sort of the moisture retention that we have. But it does give me a lot more confidence in my decisions around what we're doing. Certainly in terms of using fresh pea on the growing crop, placing that in the seedbed, I think that it's given me a bit more confidence to do that, which is good, and we're learning all the time.
Do you think that the new guidance will help your sustainable farming methods, and if so, how?
Yes, yeah, so sustainable is a big word, isn't it? But I think what we do at home is not unique, but I think it helps very much in terms of what we're doing longer term for our soil health. But I think that the change in guidance is good, because it's making people more aware of what they're doing, it's making people think about what they're doing, and maybe target nutrition a bit better, and also perhaps not necessarily aim for high indices all the time, or for strong indices. Maybe they're happy to apply fresh and just maintain what's in the ground by the nature of sort of what's naturally there.
And do you think the new guidance will help you save money?
We did some work recently, and we looked at roughly what I'm spending on my soils, and it works out about £100 a hectare a year. So we're spending quite a lot, and I suppose to a certain extent, if we do cut back on that organic manure, then yes, it will save us a little bit of money. In terms of what the guidance showing us, again, yeah, maybe a little bit, but I'm not looking at it and thinking, fantastic, this is going to wipe X amount, improve my bottom line because I can cut this amount out of my inputs. It's just not the nature of where we are in terms of what we're doing.
One of the things that Roger Sylvester Bradley spoke about was this idea of analysing your grain to supplement your soil analysis. Is this something that you think you'll start doing on your own farm?
So we've been part of the End project for quite a few years, and we sort of dip in and dip out depending on whether I think I've got any chance of doing any good at all. And as part of the End, we've had some grain analysis done, and it's really, really good. And I think we have to be aware that it's very easy for us to test either the soils or to do tissue tests. They're both common and well known, but no one actually looks at it after harvest and takes that test of the grain to find out whether our strategy was correct. So yeah, we will continue to do that going forwards, because it's a great indicator of what we did. Was it right or was it wrong? And as we manipulate and change and start to think ahead in terms of our nutrition a bit more carefully, and fresh pea in particular, we'll find out whether A, it's giving yield benefit, but also is it actually making its way through into the grain.
That's all for this week's episode. I'd like to thank my guests, Sajjad Awan, Professor Roger Sylvester Bradley, and James Price, as well as my co-producer, Jason Pohl. The updated version of RB209 is available now. You can download your copy by visiting ahdb.org.uk/ RB209. The updated version of RB209 is available now. You can download your copy by visiting ahdb.org.uk/RB209. You can also use this page to download the RB209 app to both Android and iOS devices. I'm Tom Hebbett. Thanks for listening.